Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
I'm Ben. As always, we are joined by our super producer, Noel Maple Syrup Brown.
Maple syrup, but
I'm reaching on that.
Yeah,
one.
I guess so. Maybe. Boy, I'm going to have to. I mean, there's the obvious one, but
sure.
Let's hold off on that.
Okay,
and then maybe as we go through, as we sometimes
as
do,
we are wont.
Yeah,
to
maybe
do.
There'll be something along the way that we can bring up here.
Well,
how about Iroquois?
Ooh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Noel Iroquois Brown.
Now, I hope we mention that. I mean,
right.
If we forget to mention that part of the whole story. Then,
yeah, we're not going to paint ourselves in the corner here, Scott. We'll get to it. We have to now.
Yeah, I think
we owe it to you. You're also here. You're the listener. Hopefully, you're still you. And
hopefully still listening after that intro.
And hopefully still listening after that intro. So we would like to start today's episode with a couple pieces of listener mail.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We've got a... I guess back by popular demand is Clayton with his car reviews. Now Clayton is as you recall. Now I think the story's changed a little bit here, and I believe I've mentioned this too. Clayton is a welder by profession. In his off time, he would test vehicles for manufacturers. He would drive and test vehicles. So he drove a lot of vehicles. I think now he has sort of given up on the welding thing and is going back to school to become a teacher.
Oh,
so
cool.
He's attending university at this point, and I'm not going to go much more into depth on that, but he's still testing vehicles, which is good news for us because he likes to write in with
brutally honest reviews.
Yeah, quick ones too, like nothing too lengthy. But before we get to just a few more of those, he sent in about five or six of these.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a couple little bonus things as well.
Mm-hmm.
But he asked a question in a separate email that was what I thought was a pretty good question and one that maybe some of our listeners have had along the way as well.
All right.
So here it is. It's a truck question. I thought it was a really good question from him. He says, speaking of trucks, and we were talking about his 99 Ford Ranger that he drives.
Right. Yeah.
One of two that he owns, different types of vehicles. He says, there's something I've been curious about. The four most common pickup trucks in South Texas, and that's critical that he lives in South Texas, mm-hmm. is the Ford F-150, the Toyota Tundra, the Chevy Silverado, and the Ram 1500. And all have either some kind of Texas edition or a Lone Star edition, something like that, you know, something similar.
Right, right.
He wanted to know if in by region there was something similar, like if we had a an F-150 Georgia edition or a Silverado Peach edition, you know, something
sure,
like that.
Yeah.
And that's probably a question that a lot of our listeners have. You
right.
Know?
Like, would an Alaskan pickup truck have a Klondike edition?
Yeah, exactly. And, well, I don't know if there is a certain, like, a Klondike edition, because that sounds like it could be something.
Yeah.
Now that I think about it.
Yeah.
But there is no Silverado Peach edition, thankfully. And I think the reason that this works so well for Texas is because, well, people simply like the names that are associated with that. And there's, like, the King Ranch is down there, so mm-hmm. it makes sense to have a King Ranch edition. And I don't know if maybe they ordered so many trucks for the King Ranch that you know it necessitated them getting their own branding on a truck, you know, from Ford.
Oh yeah,
but it's interesting, you know, like the name it the Lone Star edition or you know mm-hmm. something like that. But it makes sense that Texas and trucks are tied together, and I think that is just something that everybody across the United States, across around the world, really recognizes.
Yeah,
and that's why. Now I did kind of halfway dig into special editions for regions or events or things like that. I couldn't find a whole lot, but I found this. This is kind of strange. Cleveland, like as in Cleveland, Ohio, had a special edition Cutlass in the 1970s. It was the 1977 Oldsmobile Cutlass S Coupe GCSX, and the GCSX stood for Greater Cleveland Special Edition.
Huh.
Isn't that weird?
I did not see that coming.
I don't know how many of those were made or anything like that, but there's a lot of, like, special edition cars that may or may not have a name associated with them, like the Klondike, like you mentioned.
Sure.
But lots of that going on. I don't know if there's enough for a full episode or not. We'll have to kind of dig into that.
And we'll hear from you, hopefully, right in and let us know if there's a special edition vehicle in your neck of the woods.
Yeah, like a regional thing or a state thing or whatever it happens to be. But those are somewhat unique to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's get on to the reviews. He said he's got a lot of them, actually, that he's kind of holding on to, but he can't really say anything about yet publicly.
Right, because he is testing some pre-release cars.
Yeah, and he says, you know, until they make the press announcements, you know, one way or another, he can't say whether he likes or does not like something until that is made public. So it's kind of like an embargo on this stuff.
Yeah.
All right, so here are the ones that he could do, and I'll go through these quickly. Most of them get good or kind of like a 50-50 review. There's nothing really bad in this one.
Oh, okay.
But he's holding on to a couple that are just miserably bad, but he can't say what they are yet. All right. So the 2016 Ford Flex, better than I initially thought it would be. Feels more like driving a tall station wagon than an SUV. It has a lot of room inside and is good for long-distance drives, so that's a good one. Now, one that he's kind of 50-50 about is the 2016 Honda CR-V all-wheel drive. He says it's actually a lot of fun to drive. It corners exceedingly well for a small SUV, but it can feel a little cramped inside, and it can also feel a bit sluggish on the hills. So, again, kind of half-half on that, halfway, you know, 50-50 on that one. Here's another. Hey, this is a scooter, I think. A bigger scooter. The 2016 Suzuki Bergmann 650. And he says, I should say that since I don't have a motorcycle license, I wasn't able to actually road test this one. But he was on his way back when someone asked him if he could run these vehicles back and forth to fill up the gas tanks, for whoever would be taking them out. And said that his driving of these eight vehicles that they have was like a quarter mile each, so you can't really give a good review of it, but he said it was more comfortable than he thought it would be, had more storage room than he would have thought possible, under the seat, I think. You can put your helmet and maybe a grocery bag or something like that, like maybe two grocery bags, he says. Mm-hmm. And he said there's actually a decent-sized, glove compartment there. So he says it's really, really easy to use, just kind of like a twist-and-go thing on the throttle. Very simple. The 2016 Jeep Wrangler Unlimited. Seems like it would be lots of fun off-road, but he didn't get the chance to do that because these are manufacturer tests. Yeah. It's not really like the Rubicon Trail test or anything.
Right.
That the creator would do, the manufacturer. But he says, I also regret the chance of not getting to drive it without the roof and the doors, which a lot of people like to do.
Sure.
So the road noise is not nearly as bad as I would have thought it would be. The only real downside is that the black hardtop really soaks up the heat from the South Texas sun. So, again, that's a regional thing,
yeah.
I guess, wherever you are. But everybody gets, at some point, direct sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
I know South Texas is an extreme version of that, but I would assume AC would handle that as well. And that's something that he mentions in the next one, which is the 2016 Mahindra 3540. And he says the glass cab can act like a greenhouse, even on a moderately warm day. Fortunately, the air conditioner takes care of that, and the hydrostatic transmission makes things almost foolproof. Now, the Mahindra, that's like a front-loader tractor-type vehicle. And apparently the one that he was in has kind of a glass canopy over it, so something kind of unique. It's almost like when he wrote in about the airport tug that he got to drive for, short distance.
That's cool.
Yeah, it must be just kind of like a lot vehicle there, something fun. And he says, since I only have a couple of them this time around, five or so, he wrote in about his first car, which is a 1989 Eagle Premier LX, and he said it was an extremely smooth ride, bordering on bouncy. Which is, it's not really that good for a sports car. I don't know if it's really a sports car, though.
Yeah.
Premier LX? No, I guess not. The electric system is best described as unpredictable, and it cost a fortune to fix anything on that car. Now, his current vehicle, so we mentioned the Ford Ranger, he's had it for 17 years and 210,000 miles. And he says, still going strong. It's the four-cylinder version, though, and feels like it's underpowered when it's fully loaded. He says anything that breaks, however, is easy and inexpensive to fix, so that's good. And last one is a 2007 Toyota Sequoia. Lots of legroom inside, or just lots of room inside. Great for pulling a medium-sized camper on long trips, and has used it on several cross-country trips, and he doesn't have any complaints at all about that one. So
thank you,
Clayton, for sending those in. I know people, it's funny, those are so simple and concise, just right to the point. I think that's what people like about them. Just straight to it. It's like, I like it for this reason, I don't like it for that, on to the next one.
Yeah, absolutely. I like hearing about the different vehicles all at once, in one go.
I do too, instead of having like a full article that focuses on one vehicle or you and I, we don't get to drive a lot of vehicles, really. We get to drive our own vehicles, maybe our parents' vehicles, girlfriends, wives, whatever, those vehicles, but that's it.
I was in that joyriding ring for a while.
Right.
Yeah.
A little Grand Theft Auto, maybe?
Our man on the inside was a valet.
that's quite a scam. There wasn't a legend, but, we hear about this a lot. Downtown in Buckhead, there was a Lamborghini that was taken from a lot. right outside of our office. It wasn't very far away. It was
wow.
at a hotel. Uh-huh. They normally park the cars in a circle out front, you know, kind of on show, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
They do have a big parking structure in the back, but there was a situation where I think someone, I think the deal was, I'll have to look it up again, but I think there was someone on the inside that handed the keys off to somebody after it pulled in, which is
wow.
crazy. Yeah.
I wonder if they got away with it.
I don't know. I never really.
I mean, I wonder if the mole got caught. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, I doubt it. I'm sorry. I bet the mole did. I don't know about the actual car thief or if it was returned or anything like that. But
how would you sell?
I don't know.
A car like that.
I don't know. I mean, that happens when people steal like show cars or
right.
Motorcycles that are distinctly unique in some way. You know, like there's something that somebody could easily point to and say maybe it's just parts. You know, because otherwise you're going to know exactly whose bike that is. It's a tight-knit community.
Right.
More tight-knit than you would think
That's
when you own a car
exactly.
like that or a bike like that. So, I don't know. It's a strange thing. I just don't get theft all around, really. I don't understand the whole thought process there.
Hmm.
It's kind of strange.
You don't get theft all around?
Yeah.
Yes. You're not against it, you just don't get it.
I don't get it. I don't understand why somebody would do something like that. I know it's a moral question
sure.
issue, but I just don't understand.
I'm sure there are a few people who do it for the thrill, right? Isn't that why some people like shoplift and stuff, just because there's some adrenaline based reaction?
Sure, yeah, I'm sure that's it. That's got to be it.
Because I remember hearing stories in the news that would pop up every so often about, you know, very wealthy people or even celebrities who would steal just because they enjoyed stealing.
Yeah.
So morally, they would be the opposite of you because they feel like they really get it.
I guess you're right.
Speaking of getting to things.
Polar opposites. All
right.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Speaking of getting to things, today we are going to do an episode that is a long time in coming. And I want to read part of this to you, Scott, and to you listeners. And to you, Kelly, if you are out there still, because in...
You think Kelly gave up?
I don't know. I'm not completely sure, because almost a year ago, in May of 2015, May 24th, 2015, mm-hmm. Kelly D. wrote in to reply to our U-Haul podcast.
Yeah.
And then P.S. said, I know you don't often venture into aviation, but if you were to do a podcast on the Avro Aero CF-105, it would make a great episode. This Canadian superjet was an amazing interceptor, but was canceled in 1959 on a day known as Black Friday in Canadian aviation history. Some scientists ended up working for NASA. Now that I think about it, maybe this is a story more for stuff they don't want you to know.
Okay.
So over time, we talked. Kelly and I spoke over the internets, over the tubes,
yep.
and off the air before you and I had kicked around the idea of doing this.
Yeah, that's right. And man, I don't know, a year, Ben. That seems like that's kind of like an average wait time. For us,
yeah,
recently.
That's not as bad for us.
Because we're getting so many ideas that come in that are great, and we try to comb through and sort through them, and we've had some that have gone back, through the international episode? That was like 3 years.
Okay, yeah, fair.
So, yeah, a year, I mean, sure, that's a long time to wait, but I think, let's make it worth it. How about that?
let's
give
it the
best.
Old college try.
We'll do our best, all right, so... Where do you want to start? You want to start with maybe describing who is Avro, really?
Who's Avro? Yeah,
who's
let's start
Avro?
There.
It's actually kind of a the better known way to say the actual name of the company, really, is Avro. It's actually Avro and Company.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes from the founder. The founder's name was Elliot with an A, Elliot Verdon Rowe.
Mm-hmm.
And he's actually out of Manchester, England. And so it didn't start out as a Canadian company, but I'll kind of tell you what happened. It was founded in 1910. It's of course a British aircraft manufacturer. And, they've got several designs, you know, along the way. They've had, World War I planes. They've had, planes that were, well, up into the jet era, you know, in the Cold
uh-huh.
War. And along the way, they made monoplanes, you know, single-wing airplanes. Mm-hmm. They made biplanes, and they even made triplanes prior to the First World War. So remember those kind of crazy designs where they had three wings? World War One days, I mean, like pre-World War
One. The ones that stacked like a club sandwich?
Yeah, exactly. Club sandwich. Sounds pretty good.
I didn't eat lunch yet.
Yeah, me either.
Most of my comparisons to things right now are going to be food-related.
I think my stomach has already growled in this episode. So if you heard that, that's what's going on. It's after lunch. We're missing it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, it's a British manufacturer. It started back in 1910, and the company primarily remained a British-based company, but they then ventured out later, much later actually. I think it was around for about 53 years. So it was around in existence until about 1963.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until about 1945 that when the company was actually they merged into another company called the Hawker Siddeley Aircraft Company. And the Hawker Siddeley Aircraft Company, from about 1935 on, it was kind of like it was a subsidiary of it, I guess.
Right.
That's the best way to say it. And that is that's the group that initiated Avro Canada. It was, this Hawker Siddeley group.
Right.
Who purchased the former Victory Aircraft firm in Malton, Ontario, and then renamed that operation Avro Canada Limited.
Right. So Victory Aircraft at the time was Canada's largest aircraft manufacturer. And there's an interesting piece of history here, because before about 1939 or so, before the late 30s, the Victory folks had been participating in the creation of UK aircraft in what they called shadow factories.
Shadow factories.
That's a cool name, right?
Yeah, it is.
Sounds like the name of an electronic album or something.
So what's that all about?
They wanted to produce these aircraft in safety, away from the possibility of attack or bombing.
Oh, okay. So are they literally producing these at night? Is that what's going on? They're working at night? No, I'm being serious. Are they working when they're not likely to be spotted, during the daytime if under surveillance or whatever? Or is this something that is just shadow is more of like a term like it's hidden from plain view, maybe?
You know, there are pictures about it. Maybe they're called shadow factories because they were not officially at that time part of Avro.
Yeah. Well, anyways, nighttime aircraft building. I know it wouldn't be safe or anything, but I've heard of crazier things happening.
At first, I thought you were messing with me, and I thought your next question would be, "Well, how did they design the shadows?" Right?
No, that was a legit question, because that could mean a lot of things during wartime, because there's certain blackout periods, and
right.
I just didn't know exactly what that meant. So, interesting that they called them shadow factories. That's kind of cool. Almost like, it sounds like, kind of like a Skunk Works thing almost, where it's like special projects, but kind of hidden away, the normal.
Yeah, it sounds way cooler than Skunk Works, though. Skunk Works has a feel to it for sure, but also a smell. Ba-dum-bum. Okay, so we mentioned some of the aircraft design that Avro had done in its history, right? Monoplane, even triplane.
Yeah.
And then it had another design, which concerns us for the purposes of our episode today, and that is a delta wing design.
Yeah, delta wing design. Now, that would be unique for them, that they're building something like that. But just before we move on too far past this,
sure.
And I know I'm throwing you a curveball here, but the designs that Avro is, I guess, related to or associated with, maybe,
mm-hmm.
Include the Avro 504, which was used as a trainer in the First World War. There was the Avro Lancaster, which was one of the preeminent bombers during the Second World War. And then there was a delta wing Avro Vulcan, which was used in the Cold War. Now, before we got to the Vulcan, there was this Arrow. And the Arrow is the focus of what we're talking about today. But there was another plane prior to that, which I think we need to mention, and that is the Avro Canada CF-100 Canuck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the CF-100 Canuck, as you said, Scott, is a predecessor. It has a street name, by the way, just to give you an idea. The Clunk?
The Clunk. Not a very good street name, really.
Well,
that was in service between 1952 and 1981. So this spans the Cold War, not entirely, but almost. And it's also a jet powered vehicle.
Right.
It's a aircraft, rather. And it was actually successful. It did well. Mm-hmm. It was getting dated even at that point. They wanted something a little better, a little more modern, something that was, something similar to what Convair was doing.
Yeah.
With their F-106.
Right. So it was also known as the lead sled, the Canuck or the Clunk, because it had some difficulty with maneuverability. So as we know, in any kind of wartime or military-oriented construction, everything should be considered at best the prototype for the next thing.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah. Even the finished product.
And in this case, after its history, the Clunk or the Canuck was destined, or supposedly destined, to be replaced by the subject of our podcast today, the Avro Canada CF-105 Aero.
Yeah, now this is a Delta Wing interceptor aircraft, as you mentioned, and the purpose of this would be to intercept Soviet bombers. Because the threat at the time was that Soviet bombers were going to fly across and enter Canadian airspace and possibly come down into the United States through that enormous, vast region of Canada, all of Canada, really, to our north. And this is kind of like another line of protection, I suppose. They're going to fly out, intercept them, take them down. There's a few problems with that along the way, as we'll find out.
Right.
But some stuff changed along the way that made a big difference in this whole story, really.
And this was a weird move on the Royal Canadian Air Force's part, because they began design studies in, as you said, the 50s and earlier, actually, examining different improvements possible to make on the Canuck.
Yeah.
And then they kind of Shyamalan'd it. They kind of did a M. Night Shyamalan plot twist, because they said, you know what, we're going to go for a much more powerful design, and we're going to skip the prototype phase.
Oh, yeah, that was a strange move, too, I think.
Yeah.
They were intending to, instead of making this kind of one-off vehicle that was, as you say, a prototype,
which
where they build it.
Which is the typical method.
Yeah, build in a lab. They're going to start with an assembly line.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to build the first one right on the assembly line, which makes it even more difficult. And there's a lot of other things that were incredibly difficult along the way that upped the cost of these, because the initial thought was that they were going to build something like 600 of these planes.
Right.
That was the initial plan. And the cost per vehicle was going to be something like $2 million. Canadian Royal Air Force decided that they didn't want the fire control system, the missile system, the weapons and guidance system that was at the time working in other planes. They wanted this to be unique for the Aero. And for
right.
the Aero project, and that added on to that cost, and it kept adding on and adding on mm-hmm. until we got to the point where, finally, the government reduced the number of planes that they wanted from 600 down to 100, and, the add-on of, this R&D, really, of all those missile and guidance systems.
All those new systems.
Yeah, everything that had to be added on to this, it just upped the price to something like, they were approaching $12 million per plane at this point. And,
Wow.
For the run of 100,
if you factor in that R&D.
Yeah. Exactly right. Yeah. So, and again, the year that we're talking about here, this is early 1950s.
Right. Okay. So the Mark I is rolled out in. So they're seriously developing it in the mid 50s, as you say. The Mark I RL-201 goes out to the public in October of 1957, specifically October 4th. Of 1957, an auspicious day in another country as well.
Yeah, this is critical here, because what's happening over in the Soviet Union is that they launched Sputnik, the satellite Sputnik. Now that's the so in other words, they roll out this plane, to the public, and
yeah.
and it's really pretty amazing. It's an incredible plane, but the Sputnik headline, I guess, grabbed all the attention away from that, and it really kind of fizzled on that day. And that's too bad. It was just that's the worst timing ever for something like that to happen. If it was a day later, a week later, whatever, would have made a big difference. Now, Sputnik, I think we should just mention this, because this plays into this whole Cold War thing immensely. Now, it's the world's first, and this is why it was news. A lot of people won't remember this or weren't around or just have never looked it up. It was the world's first artificial satellite, and it only had a 92-day mission, and really it was pretty simple what it did. It just sent a radio signal back to Earth, and it was just kind of like, it did take some measurements, I guess, because you could determine The drag on the outside of the of Sputnik, which was
right.
like a...
It didn't have scientific instruments.
No, but they could calculate certain things about the upper atmosphere.
Yeah, and the ionosphere based on the radio signals.
Yeah, the radio signal speed of those, and they knew how fast it should be flying, and they could calculate drag and all that. And it was interesting. It was launched, again, by the Soviet Union on October 4th, 1957, and it came back to Earth. It fell to Earth on January 4th, 1958, but it burned up on reentry. I mean, it didn't make it back.
I think this is fun for, I know this is a derailment, Scott. I apologize half-heartedly.
Oh, that's right.
But if you happen to find yourself at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, you can see the last remaining piece of the first Sputnik.
What's the last remaining piece?
It's sad, man. It's a metal arming key, and all its entire job of this little component, which looks like two key rings and sort of a razor blade shaped bracket.
Yeah.
Hanging there. The entire job was to prevent contact between the batteries and the transmitter before launch.
That was it.
It's the only thing it did.
It's like just a protective plate, really.
Right, yeah.
That's it.
So the batteries and transmitters aren't in contact.
And it's a piece that was removed before launch, so that's the only reason it's still here. Weird, huh? All right.
History.
So, yeah, I guess. Now, why it's important, why this is so important to the story also, is that the whole launch of Sputnik really triggered what the Americans called it the American Sputnik crisis.
Or the space race.
The space race, yeah, because there was this perception that the Soviet Union was technologically far more advanced than the United States at this point, and that was a great fear of ours.
Sure, a defense gap.
Well, exactly, yeah, that's a big problem. So the space race then led to the creation of NASA in 1958, and that actually, you know what, NASA wasn't the first group that did something like that. There was a group prior to that that was formed in 1915 called NACA, N-A-C-A.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics. And that is what in turn formed in or changed into NASA in 1958. So that's the group that predates that. But
and Canada being part of the West was part of this race as well. So this international pressure and competition, this concern of the Cold War, of fingers inches away from the big red button that says nuke, this concern really drove the economics of the time. And so as soon as the RL-201 rolls out, it's extensively tested, and they're finding, the testers, the scientists, the evaluators are finding that this far outperforms the Klunk. It's got better handling, and it's more reliable in numerous ways. And then they begin replacing some of the engines because they had the RL-202 and through 204 come out, and those were using Pratt & Whitney J75 engines,
mm-hmm.
which are a turbojet engine that was popular in the 50s. However, that was not quite the ideal engine at the time, and that's when they stumbled upon...
Yeah, the Arenda Iroquois engine, right? So we finally got around to it. We remembered the Iroquois thing mm-hmm. for Noel's nickname.
Look at that, man.
Amazing.
At us.
I know. It's been a long time. I'm surprised we didn't forget.
We are moving on up, Mr. Benjamin.
All right, so the Arenda Iroquois engine was right. built by Arenda Engines, which was a... it's actually a part of the Avro-Canada group, so it's like a division, another subsidiary
like,
of Avro-Canada.
Like you said earlier, it's an in-house design.
Yeah, exactly. They designed it, they built it, and it was specifically for the Arrow, and they did testing, you know, like they were ready to do... I guess getting it ready for flight and testing, but never quite actually made it. I think maybe they had installed them. You know, there's some weirdness that happens with planes left on the line in a moment that we'll talk about, but
uh-huh.
I don't know if it ever actually flew with one of those Iroquois engines or not. Not sure.
Hmm. But that was the intent, at least.
Yeah, it was getting ready for taxiing and testing and stuff like that. So it was on its way. Ben, you know, before we go too much farther here, can I just take just a moment to mention something that's been kind of bugging me here?
Oh, please.
That
do.
We haven't said.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems to me that the Canadian aviation industry was really, really strong at mm-hmm. this point. Very,
yeah.
very strong. I mean, aerospace, anything around aviation was very, very strong in Canada, and that's not typically where we don't think of that, you know, them as being strong in that industry today. And the reason is because of what we're going to talk about soon here. But it's generally thought that, maybe I'm giving it all away here, but I think we've already said that, you know, they shut it down, right? So
that's the truth.
I mean, should I just
let's just get the badger
right,
out of
so
the bag.
So it is shut down, but there's kind of like this big what if question that's left out there. Like,
yes.
And here's how strong it was in Canada at the time. They said that if the company had been left alone to kind of create and develop these new technologies, like mm-hmm. you know that they thought they were going to do, this Avro group, Canada very likely would have put a man on the moon, which is kind of crazy for me to think about.
It sounds
really
crazy, but let's consider. Let's walk through it. Because at the time, March 25th, 1958, the first test flight of the Arrow, they already found that it was amazing for the time. It could reach nearly three times the speed of sound. It could travel an altitude of 60,000 feet. And this became a symbol of unity to the Canadian population.
Well, sure, national pride, right?
Right.
I mean, this is the crowning jewel of their whole group at this point. You know, I don't know, maybe that's not the best way to say that, but it's something that all of them can stand behind and say, hey, we Canadians built this, and it's right now. It's right at the top. It's something that not many people are doing. Not many countries are doing.
Yeah, it's a flagship. It's a flagship plane. It's a crown and the jewel of Canada's aerospace industry. That's
a better way to say it.
That comment, the man on the moon statement. I heard that from the CEO of the Canadian Air and Space Museum.
Oh, okay.
Rob Cohen.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's an interesting proposition because they were on the forefront of such technology at the time.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that Avro had a couple of other concepts that were kind of on the drawing board when all this went down, too. And I promise we'll get to the shutdown in just a moment here, but they had a lunar rover concept vehicle that they were already testing. They had a flying saucer car, which was they called the Astro car, or I'm sorry, Avro car. But it looks like a flying saucer on the ground. It's kind of an interesting idea. I don't know exactly what the deal was with that, but they were constantly developing and looking to what's new, what's next in Canada, and specifically this Avro group. It was an enormous place. I mean, it had tens of thousands of employees. It was a giant, giant industry at the time in Canada. And not just them. There's other, you know, Canadian aviation industry players as well.
Right.
It's just this is the one we're focusing on for this whole thing. And a lot of the, I don't know, can you call it the brain trust, I guess? A lot of the brain trust in that industry in Canada was working for Avro at the time. That's why what happened on February 20th, 1959 was such a horrific blow to, again, national pride, Canada in general, really. I mean, people to this day are very, very angry about what happened in 1959, early 1959.
Black Friday.
Yeah, Black Friday. Yeah, they actually call it Black Friday in the Canadian aviation community because of exactly what happened. This is the cancellation of the project.
And people still argue about why it was canceled.
Okay. There's a lot of there's conspiracy theories, of course.
Sure.
We can tell you kind of the generally understood, you know, the consensus, I guess, of, you know, why it happened. And mainly it comes down, I mean, the general idea is that it mainly came down to cost. The aircraft was getting too expensive, even though a lot of the fault of that was, you know, partially from the Royal Canadian Air Force, who wanted, you know, those extra systems that they could have just changed or adopted from other vehicles that were already out there that had them.
Yeah,
they insisted on brand new, though.
Right. The official story is that the government at the time said that, look, the Aero program is just too expensive. It's not worth the money. It's costing us millions.
Yeah, and then, of course, other people would say, well, they killed it because they wanted to use the money for other projects that they had going that weren't maybe as important in their mind. The timing was a little bit different, too, because, one thing that they said it was bad timing was because the Soviets had already tested an intercontinental ballistic missile.
An ICBM.
Yeah, and what happens then is that kind of cancels out the need to have an interceptor that can intercept a Soviet bomber because the bomber is no longer necessary. They can just simply shoot a missile that can reach Canada, or the shores of Canada or the United States from the Soviet Union. So no need to intercept bombers anymore, so we don't need to work on this interceptor project anymore. That's one reason. That's one of the many bad timing
here's
episodes.
Here's another reason that I think is fairly solid. Around this time, NORAD is created, too, and one of the deals with NORAD one of the standing agreements was that Uncle Sam would buy some new Avro arrows. However, in the course of negotiations, at some point, the U.S. said they didn't want to, you know, they pulled out of the deal.
Well, okay,
or the changing Canadian government at the time pulled them out of the deal.
Okay, so this vehicle that they're working on, the Arrow, is claimed or is said to be the most advanced military aircraft in the world at the time, right?
Right.
That was the promotional stuff, you know, what they say when they go out with their PowerPoint presentation or whatever. Not that they had PowerPoint in 1958, but you know what I mean. When they
right.
go out to present this, they say it's the most advanced military aircraft in the world at this point. Now, the problem with that statement is that there's another aircraft that is very, very similar that was already out there 4 years prior to that. It's the one I mentioned earlier, the Convair F-106 Delta Dart. And now, I'm no expert in this, but I can go by what, you know, I've seen written about this vehicle and, or this aircraft rather.
Uh-huh.
And they say that it was just as fast. It was somewhere around Mach 2.3, I think was the top end of it. And, I think you said that they were promising that the Arrow was going to be somewhere around 3 times the speed of sound.
Right.
Okay. So that's a little bit faster, but then I only saw numbers that went up to like, just slightly below Mach 2 on the Arrow, but that was, again, that's prototype testing.
Right.
So, again, this Convair F-106, it has a slightly higher service ceiling, which means it can fly a little bit higher, almost twice the radius of action, which means that it can fly twice the distance, really. It wasn't quite as thirsty as the Arrow was. It was also available 4 years earlier, as I said, and several times cheaper than the CF-105 eventually became after all those add-ons. So, you know, when it was in the $8 to $10 million range, the F-106 was still right around $2 million, and they were actually building, they were flying, they were the real deal at the time.
Right.
Now, the F-106 was kind of like the United States Air Force, kind of like their workhorse. They used that all the time. I mean, it was something that, it's like their backbone, I guess.
Mm.
They used it as an interceptor. It was an all-weather interceptor, and it was later replaced by the F-15 Eagle, but for that time, though, I mean, here's an aircraft that's already there doing what they're trying to create the Arrow to do, and I know that that's one of the what I just mentioned, all this about the Convair.
Yeah,
that will get some people very, very angry, and they'll say that you can't compare these two, and here's the reason, and I'm saying this because I don't want to get the angry emails. The problem with the comparison that's being made between the F-106 and the unbuilt, I guess, CF-105s was that they were comparing the prototype Arrow to the finished product, you know, in the Convair.
That's a really
good
point.
Yeah, I mean, it's an excellent point because, you know, with the Iroquois engines that we mentioned, they hadn't even had a chance to really use those yet. I mean, we're still talking about the specs that were given for the Pratt Whitney J-75s. And, you know, other things like that, it was not a finished product. They were still developing this along the way when other people were saying, well, they've already got a plane that will do exactly this. They were going to make one that was going to be better is the idea.
Right.
That was the plan. But then, of course, 1959 happens and, early 1959 happens. And, man, is this a blow to the aviation industry.
15,000 jobs lost.
Unbelievable. Like overnight, they just cancel it. They have to can 15,000 AV Row employees. They're fire, you know, and all the divisions and everything. Again, they call Black Friday for good reason. I get it. It had been horrible for national pride. They say that the aerospace, you know, the aircraft and aerospace industry in Canada has never quite been the same since that day in 1959. And I believe it because what happened was a lot of scientists and engineers fled from Canada to the United States, you know, for jobs. They came over for, to work for NASA. And if you bear with me for just one second, I've got a note about that because I think the number was something like 32 of like the top-notch engineers and designers came to work for NASA.
Wow.
So or eventually made their way to NASA.
You lose your team, huh?
Yeah, I mean, and I'm sure that, you know, there were many, many other people, but that was like the top tier of you know, the ones that were working on that. And Canadians saw this as kind of a brain drain, you know, the best of the best of their industry were headed to the United States to work on, you know, the new NASA group. And they felt like, well, we just missed the boat on this. This is why they said, and, you know, back to the what if thing.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of what if questions that are asked about this. That if they had let the company be, left it alone, Let the program continue and let them develop as they had been over the past, you know, decade or so, or even more. There's a chance that Canada would have put a man on the moon. It's
so
crazy to
amazing,
think about.
Huh?
Yeah, that's where that all comes from. You know, that's why they're so bitter about this. And I get it. I really do. I understand the angst there.
And ever since Canada has been using foreign combat aircraft, it's interesting because a group of industry and business leaders based in Canada launched a move to resurrect the Avro Aero program. Did you hear about that?
No, I did not. That's interesting.
It's interesting, but they just pitched a redesign of it back in 2012 or so as an alternative to purchasing F-35s.
Okay, well, here's the problem with resurrecting this program is that you'd be going with blueprints and all that because there's not an entire aircraft that was left alone. And that's part of the mystery around this whole thing, right?
Right.
Once the program was canceled, within 2 months, the government just ordered all of the materials, the assembly line, every finished plane or nearly finished plane had to be disassembled and destroyed. So there are bits and pieces here and there, and this is a...
Because they built five, and apparently there was a sixth one that was almost ready.
Yeah, it was very, very close to being ready, and, you know, all in various stages of completion. So, you know, all of them had a little something wrong with them, you know, because they're prototypes.
Right.
At this point, I think they did fly one, as we mentioned. Mm-hmm. Actually, a few of them have flown at some point, all for the same pilot.
And we have a mystery, too.
Yeah, this myth, I like this. It's kind of a legend, right?
Yeah.
Because... All these, I'll just give you the lay of the land right now is that there are pieces of these planes around. They're on display in aviation museums here and there. I mean, they're scattered here and there. And in some places, like there'll be, and one of these Iroquois engines will be kind of like pushed away in a corner and maybe covered up with a tarp somewhere in a hangar. Pieces that were actually, they were kind of stolen. They were smuggled out of that factory because everything was supposed to be destroyed. So anything you see of an Avro Aero is something that was smuggled out, including that giant nose piece that's on display in one of the aviation museums. I mean,
right.
It's like the whole front end of the plane. They snuck it out under the cover of night, I guess maybe it was from the Shadow Factory, Ben.
Maybe it was from the Shadow Factory.
No, they stole it. They stole it because they wanted a piece of that history to remain preserved, even though the program was gone. And here's how weird this gets, is that they asked some of the officials later on, you know, the Royal Canadian Air Force officials that they came out to this is much, much later, by the way.
Right.
Came out to view a piece that, you know, someone had, I guess, smuggled away, and they kind of wanted to know what they could do with it or what they should do with it. And the guy said, you know what, just keep it back here under wraps until the climate is significantly changed in Ottawa. And that way we can then bring it out and display it without having any kind of repercussions. And I don't know when that happened exactly. You know, if it was right, it must have been a lot closer to 1959 than it is now. Cause that stuff's, you know, openly displayed at this point. But again, all those pieces, bits and pieces are a stolen property, really.
Right. And there was a great story in 2011 from CTV News where, I'll just read the first part. The discovery of an intact ejection seat from Canada's legendary Avro Aero is fueling a half-century-old conspiracy theory that one of the purportedly destroyed jets was smuggled to safety.
A full jet.
A full jet.
Yeah, so a working Aero is said to be out there somewhere.
See, guys, did you know that we were going to bring that vehicle theft stuff back around?
I knew you'd do it.
Forget stealing sports cars from Buckhead. Steel jets from Canada. I'm kidding.
It's so much easier. You ever see, what is it, Airplane Repo? Is that the name of it?
Airplane Repo.
Yeah, have you ever seen that show?
Oh, wait, is that the show you told me about?
Yeah.
I thought you were joking, where they go and take the private planes of
people that have
morally well-to-do.
Well, yeah, someone who has stopped making payments on their plane, or you know, there's a dispute over who owns it or whatever, and it's like a repo man, but they take airplanes and they do it. Okay, here we go again, under the cover of night. Sometimes they do this, and crazy thing is, they got to go into these hangars like that are guarded. Of course, they've got dogs, they've got barbed wire, they've got all this, and they sneak in. They have to inspect the plane. They have to do pretty much like the ground inspection with a flashlight in a hangar that, you know, they can't turn the lights on in. They have to practically bribe somebody to drive, or they do it themselves, where they have a tug that pulls them out to the runway,
yeah.
And then they take off. And it's the craziest thing. Like sometimes they're taking off as the owner is arriving, you know, shaking his or her fist at him. It's a crazy show. It's actually pretty good. It's maybe not what you're initially thinking.
Would you do airport repo, airplane repo, Scott?
If I could fly, I would. It looks like fun, but it also looks very dangerous. It looks very, very dangerous. I mean, anytime you're taking something that someone feels is their property, even though they've stopped paying on it, you know, many months ago.
Right.
Or even years ago.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times it's just a matter of tracking these things down.
We had,
that's dangerous business.
A while back, gosh, years back, we got some great and kind of gritty stories from a guy who was working as a repo man.
We did a repo truck episode, and maybe that's what spawned that.
Yeah.
Could have been, yeah. Hey, you know, one last quick thing is that what kind of added a little bit of fuel to this whole fire is an interview that was done in 1968 by a guy, I think he's an air marshal, and World War One flying ace. World War One flying ace.
Wow.
That's a long gone way back.
I mean, especially when you consider the rate of attrition for pilots in World War One.
Yeah, he's an air marshal, and his name was Wilford Austin Curtis, and they asked him just point blank, do you have one? Did you hide one? Because they think that this is the guy that did it. They think this is the guy that took it.
Yeah.
And so in kind of a dodgy answer, he says, he kind of says like, well, I don't know if the political climate would be right to reveal that kind of information at this point or something like that. Something like that. It was like a real dodgy answer to the question that was very direct. And again, that was in 1968. So I don't know. It just adds fuel to this legend that
I can
it's still out there.
Yeah, I can add as well. So earlier that story about the ejection seat, mm-hmm. not injection seat, something totally different.
That would be totally different.
Well, the story involves a guy named Chris Wilson, who at the time was the managing director of a place called Jet Art Aviation. It's a British company that sells aircraft collectibles. And he believes in this theory that the Avro escaped Canada. But also, apparently, ex-Royal Air Force members, that's British Air Force essentially, say that the existence of an Arrow in the UK was a local legend within the force.
Really?
During the 1960s.
So lending a little bit of credibility in that, you know, these are the guys on the inside that are mm-hmm. saying somewhere there is one. We know it's, maybe they've seen it. Maybe they know exactly where it is.
Apparently eyewitnesses traced it to the RAF Manston Air Base near Kent, but there is no hard proof of that.
Interesting. This is I like it when we have a like one missing type story. You know, like where you know someone builds a bunch of cars and they put them in a showroom and they just disappear one day. And like the three,
right.
What was it? The Heine Velux vehicles that we talked about that just disappeared.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's a ton
somebody
of these along
took
the way.
Them on the best last day of work ever. That's what happened. But also, you know, again, folks, and especially you, Kelly, the idea that one of these could be smuggled out is enormously controversial. And a lot of people just flat out do not believe it, including one of a guy named Robin Sipe, who is one of the only owners of an engine made for the Avro Arrow.
Oh, really? That may have been the one that I saw then. It was kind of just tucked away in some aircraft hangar somewhere. It didn't look like it was on display anywhere, really.
Uh-huh.
Maybe that's the one I've seen. But you know what I find most interesting about this, I guess, is like the aftermath of the whole thing. I mean, Canadians, of course, really, really angry about this, and for good reasons, as we said. People are talking about how, you know, the prime minister at the time, what's his name? Diefenbacher, I think? Diefenbacher? I don't know how to pronounce his name, but they think that, you know, at the time they said it's going to turn out to be one of the most colossal blunders that have ever been made by a prime minister in the history of Canada. You know, it was like a
wow.
huge statement like that. Like, it's the worst thing that could ever happen, but the conventional thought is that it made sense to cancel the program because it was just getting too expensive. It wasn't the right thing for Canada at the time. You know, all these factors that we've been telling you about, the timing and, you know, the bad, just bad timing. It all added up to, you know, the program just not really having much of a future, I guess. And I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, we're going to get opinions probably both ways on this thing because people get very, very, upset about this. This is a polarizing topic for sure. The other thing is that for Canadians, they saw the cancellation of this as kind of like a blow to, again, like their national dream, you know, their national pride.
Uh-huh.
They saw it like, here's the way it was said in one article. They said that they saw it in a way that their leaders did not have the courage or the vision to forge a coherent defense policy independent of the United States, meaning they had to rely again on the United States for defense, and they didn't want that. That's part of what this whole program was about. And again, just fostering that creative atmosphere that that Avro had. Really, they had that mentality. They had that group of people there that could have done a lot, and just never got the chance. So the what ifs of this whole thing are probably the most intriguing part for me.
And what do you think, Canadian listeners? Was the Arrow shut down for worthwhile purposes, or was there something more to the story? Because I had heard people arguing that the U.S. was purposefully crippling Canada from an aerospace perspective.
That's an interesting twist on the whole thing. I mean, there's a lot of things like that. You could read a lot into this.
Right.
Going back and looking at the situation. So, yeah, I would love to hear some of the maybe some of the lesser known conspiracy theories about this whole thing.
Right. Yeah. And we also like to know if you think there might still be an Avro Arrow out there in the wild somewhere. Talk about the most amazing barn find.
That would be incredible.
And you can write to us regarding this. We're on Facebook and Twitter. We're CarStuffHSW on both of those. If you want to check out our earlier podcast, especially the U-Haul one we mentioned earlier, then please visit our website, carstuffshow.com, where you can find every single audio podcast we have ever done. You could go to iTunes as well if you wish, but I think they only show the first 300.
There. Yeah, I think that's not even half.
That's not even half anymore. We've been at it for a while. And if you would like to take a page from Kelly's book or Clayton's book and write into us with a recommendation for an additional topic, some thoughts on the Avro Arrow, or your brutally honest car reviews, we'd love to hear from you. Our address is
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.